On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up. The new equation.
This week, the makeup of the British Empire has shifted a little bit. We have the Republic of Barbados taking its place among the nations of the world this week. The Queen no longer the head of state, but Rihanna officially declared as a national treasure, and so say all of us. A century ago this week, however, the shifting makeup of that empire wasn't concerning Barbados, it was concerning us, because as we know, the Anglo-Irish Treaty was being trashed out on this week a century ago. And it wasn't just over the negotiating table that there were some disputes, because there was a vicious media war playing out on the press on these islands as well. Now, to some journalists, it was seen as almost a disgrace that men like Michael Collins were able to sit at the top table of high politics alongside Churchill and Lloyd George. The Dáil sent press secretaries and more to try and win over the ear and the influence of the British mainstream press. Question, of course, is did they listen? And that's something that Donal Fallon has been investigating, and he's dropped in to give us another little illumination into all things past. Donal, the setting of today's story is a stone's throw from London's fashionable high streets, but it's a fairly unlikely setting.
Yeah, I have spent this week in the archives of the Daily Mail and the Spectator, so don't say I don't suffer from my art, because I do. But yeah, the setting of this story today...
You haven't come back like fuming over the... You've basically come back like a Punch cartoon. Yeah. Those drunken, porcine Irish.
And the Illustrated London News, actually, yeah. Hans Place in London, if anyone's been there. It's a very fashionable garden square in the heart of London. More specifically, it's in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, SW1, and it is posh. And if you walk around it, you get the sense it's very, very important. You know, there's plaques everywhere. 23 was home to Jane Austen. The square is named in honour of a collector whose collection became the basis of the British Museum. And okay. One online account notes that it attracts the super rich. That's a ridiculous line, right?
I was going to say, before you even said it, I was at Kensington. I think I know where that is, because I think I've walked past it on the way to the place that you're about to describe.
Yes, get this for the most ridiculous line ever said in this slot. The super rich are particularly attracted to Hans Place because it is the garden square with the closest proximity to Harrods. Very, very,
very
important.
Hugely important.
But a century ago...
It's like living beside the Lewis, basically.
Hans Place was the unlikely setting for high drama in Irish diplomatic history. That was where Dáil Éireann's treaty delegation took up residence in number 22, right next door to Jane Austen's home. And a lot has been written and said this week about the treaty negotiations, but of course, it's tended to focus on the men who found themselves around the table of high politics. Mm. And they're remarkable people. You know, Welsh wizard Lloyd George, Winston Churchill, Hammer Greenwood, a Rottweiler for politician, Arthur Griffith, Michael Collins. But beyond the kind of direct negotiation of these men, as we're going to talk about today, a lot else was happening, especially in the kind of media war to shape the narrative. So we'll hear terms today like fake news and the like, and we'll realise there's nothing new about a lot of this stuff.
Hammer Greenwood, by the way, the grandfather, or possibly the great-grandfather, of the models and socialites Poppy and Cara Delevingne. And apparently Cara Delevingne apparently named after the Aer Lingus in-flight magazine, because the father had flown over and back so many times and just really liked the name. The media war, long underway though, before the days of Hans Place, and to some extent actually, in the global media war, the Irish had the upper hand.
Yeah, Revolutionary Ireland was, I think, to the eternal annoyance of London, very, very good at playing the press. And between 1919 and 21, when the war is on in Ireland, they produced two newspapers. One is called An Tógálach, The Volunteer, which is aimed at the volunteer in the field of war. And, you know, Joe Public never sees that newspaper. But the other one is called The Irish Bulletin, which provides news and reports from the Republican perspective. And The Irish Bulletin's a really interesting newspaper because it's not aimed at us. You know, it's not a newspaper in a traditional sense that you can buy off the shelves. Mm. It's a fact sheet, and its intended audience are journalists.
Okay. So it's literally about shaping the media narrative, as we'd call it today.
Absolutely, exactly. Shaping the narrative. And the Irish Bulletin, the aim is to get that newspaper at the hotel room door of journalists who are kind of dispatched to Dublin and reporting on the conflict. And even better, if you can manage, and they do manage this, is to land it on the desk of journalists in London and beyond. So it's a dangerous thing to be producing a newspaper of an underground revolutionary seditious parliament, but they do it. And the very brave typist who makes it happen, Kathleen McKenna, later Kathleen Napoli McKenna. What a great name.
She's not named after like Maradona's team of the 1980s.
It reflects her love for an Italian general and not a love of Italian calcio.
Okay, right.
But she remembered that it was taught by us that by making personal contacts with the London correspondents of foreign publications, much could be done to arouse interest in Ireland's fight and induce them to us. If they found interesting enough, they might use the news we would give them. So okay, right. This was an extraordinary effort, and it really, really got under the nose of Dublin Castle. Yeah. But Chile's great accounts of how they do it. I mean, they sneak through cordons, they move the very bulky equipment all over Dublin. They're in an office on Harcourt Street, a shop on Bagot Street, a basement in Rathmines, a flat in Pembroke Street, and at one stage they're in McKenna's own digs on Drumcondra. Okay. So
that was during Spanish flu. They had to work from home.
Yeah, work from home. So it wasn't exactly the lap of luxury, but it was a very, very important piece of work. And that newspaper really does shape the war. And when the treaty delegation head off to London, it's no great surprise that they bring that mechanism with them. They bring people like Kathleen McKenna, and they're conscious that when we go to London, we win the ears of the press.
And one reason why the Irish Bulletin might have particularly got up the noses of Dublin Castle and of the British governing mechanisms is because the Brits actually, despite having, you know, just won a world war, they themselves weren't quite so good at propaganda.
The British government and the war departments are really abysmal in the propaganda war, and there's some incredible hiccups. Probably the worst one is the Battle of Tralee, which is...
I think we've mentioned this on this lot before, actually.
Yeah, incredible. It's presented to the British public as a hammer blow against the IRA. There's, you know, pictures on the front of British newspapers, like the Illustrated London News, of a battle that never actually happens. You know, it's a fake battle. It's staged in Killiney in Dublin. And anyone familiar with Killiney looking at the pictures will recognise it immediately. And they even circulate fake reports in the British press that they claim are from the Irish Bulletin. Because most British people have never seen this newspaper. Mm. They just know it exists. So kind of notes of surrender and the like from the Irish Bulletin. Yeah. And Michael Barry, the historian, he's written a recent book on this, and he calls it Fake News in the Irish Revolution. Because that's exactly what it was fake news. So by comparison to the world's most successful and expanding empire, actually it's these the young bucks of Dáil Éireann, and their propaganda machine is well oiled by comparison, and now they bring it with them into the open. So
I'm really struck and quite amused actually by this idea that they were just making up the reports of the foreign press. It's a little bit like when it's transfer window season in like the English football and you're saying, oh well, Marca says that Cristiano Ronaldo is going to be signing for Alaves, and like you go back and it's been translated through Google Translate somebody times that the thing they're citing never actually happened at all. Parking that tangent for a second, the British, not only did they have to contend with the propaganda war, but they also, part of the reason why they were finding it so difficult to try and convince their own public was because the British press didn't even feel like the talks should be happening. They almost saw sitting down with the Irish as a betrayal.
It's a weird anomaly because their traditional opponent, the British government in the press, is the Liberal press, you know, the Manchester Guardian and the like, who are outraged by the kind of the reprisals in Ireland and all of that. And their traditional ally is the more conservative press. Now things have switched around, and the conservative press are shouting at the government, what are you doing? You know, why are you stopping the war now? So the fact
it's the 1990s, you're sitting down with terrorists.
Exactly, exactly. There's the truce that allows the treaty talks to begin, it just infuriates them. They regard it as a surrender in all but name. And there's a demand from some people within the Conservative Party that before we let people like Michael Collins sit at the table in Downing Street, the IRA needs to surrender arms as a prerequisite to talks. Again, history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. This was never really going to happen. And in the words of one British newspaper, The Spectator, it was a monstrous betrayal to negotiate with such people. So, you know, unlikely sections of the British press, the old allies, are now down the neck, if you will, of the government.
The first media scrum of the treaty talks happens in a train station, and there's photographers and there's thousands of people there waiting to try and doorstep the Irish delegation, but the British press are only focused in one man, which is Michael Collins.
When the treaty delegates arrive in Britain, it's a great story. They arrive, you know, via boat and train. The journey brings them to Holyhead and then on to Euston Station in London, and there's an absolute circus at the London train station. And the Irish media are all there, kind of fighting for space beside the British. And to quote the Freeman's Journal, it was a reception which astonished all who witnessed it. The fervour of the crowd was intense. In the matter of numbers, the Irish section of the crowd was into 3,000 or 4,000. But the British press are focusing on one thing. They're watching these Irish guys get off the train. And the one who isn't there is Michael Collins.
He's not there. Okay.
He travels later from the other delegates. And it's clear that he's the boogeyman from that point on in the press coverage. But then at Hans Place, something really remarkable happens. And the Irish public don't learn about this because it's not picked up on in the Irish press, but it's all over the British press. Someone kind of whitewashes or scrawls the word murderer, or some accounts specifically suggest Collins the murderer, into the pavement outside the Dáil's residence. There's also a wreath laid at the cenotaph in memory of British soldiers murdered, as it says in Ireland. That's a very symbolic, highly charged act of protest. So these kind of things are picked up on in the British press, and there's something very dangerous, really, in the talk around Collins in that press too, as if this one man had somehow sustained a 3-year guerrilla war. But people are whipped into a frenzy, and you see that at Hans Place.
Yeah, you sort of wonder then whether that is in itself the product of London Titles misreporting stuff that's been said in the apparent Irish press, and then lionising this man who maybe hadn't necessarily done as much as was alleged. How did Collins himself find all of that, this idea that he was the national bogeyman and that there was whitewash on the pavement outside the house?
Brilliantly, Collins seems to have collected the press clippings about himself and sent some of them home to his beloved. So he found some of it quite humorous. And one letter home, he writes, "What do you think of the enclosed? The writing is all bosh. I never said any of these things. Just a few remarks. Newspaper men are inventions of the devil." Isn't that a great line?
Wow.
And whatever about the journos, who Collins clearly doesn't like, the photographers are something he really tries to get away from. And you see that in the images of Collins making his way through the streets of London. They're at Downing Street, and look at how awkward Collins is, rushing past them, someone who was very consciously avoiding photographers for years up to this point.
Because you have to remember that through 1919 and 1920, they didn't really want their whereabouts to be very public figures, because they were always going to be in somebody's crosshairs. So they're always trying to keep a low profile.
And as you know, in your line of work, I mean, politicians generally run in front of cameras. They don't run away from them. So it's a very strange and unlikely celebrity that befalls Collins.
Poor Collins was very unfortunate that he lived in the days before you could put a mobile phone to your ear to pretend that you're on some very important call. While the journalists are trying to doorstep you afterwards. The great trick these days is to ring a minister while they're walking past you, and then seeing while they've got the phone up to the rear,
if it rings,
then to hear it ringing. It's happened once. I won't say who the unfortunate minister was, but it was quite amusing to everyone who saw it. One of the main victories of the Irish in the media war was in this idea of kind of creating a buzz around themselves, this idea of actually becoming attraction, almost harnessing the apparent star power that they had in the British press.
They definitely seized on the potential that London brought. There was just a lot more journalists in London than there was in Dublin. And one of the strings in their bow, I think, was Desmond Fitzgerald, father of Garrett, a poet. He'd been born in London. He had very significant kind of social and cultural connections there, real bohemian character. And as well as being a journalist himself, you know, he was one of the key figures in producing the Irish Bulletin. But he knew a lot of people in London, and he kind of took advantage of that. So there's a steady stream of cultured visitors who want to meet the Irish delegation. George Bernard Shaw, the very influential poet Ezra Pound. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, you know, no Irish people had caused so much commotion in London since perhaps Oscar Wilde.
I was nearly going to say, because we've discussed on this slot before when Oscar Wilde went on an American speaking tour and he just became this massive celebrity where the great and the good all wanted to go and have a drink and spend some time with him. And it almost seems like the great and the good are all lining up at 22 Hans Place to go and visit the Irish.
Absolutely. And Desmond Fitzgerald takes the credit for that. He built that sense of buzz around the delegation. So the media image of Sinn Féiners, as they're termed in the press, is, you know, the savage, the people that are shooting policemen in the back down kind of rural Irish roads. But then there's this really prestigious feeling in Who Wants to Knock on Their Door that changes that narrative. So there's a real kind of constant buzz around Hans Place, and it's an orchestrated buzz. And the American media are kind of invited in big numbers and are accommodated. So Sinn Féin played that very, very well on the world stage.
I suppose the funny thing about all of this is that in the end, if the press had proven itself to be so easily malleable by the Irish who were going over there, that then the media was also able to spin the treaty in whatever way they wanted. And that meant that you had maybe competing narratives about what exactly the treaty ended up containing.
Yeah, and that's what's so interesting about this centenary to me. I mean, the Anglo-Irish Treaty, it's a remarkable document, it, just as the Good Friday Agreement was, you know, in that it can be editorialised in whatever way one chooses. And to both sides, it was either a victory or a defeat, depending on what a journalist chooses to emphasise. So for some British newspapers, this is humiliating. It's a deal that's negotiated with terrorists. It's a surrender. To other British newspapers, it's a triumph because the Irish didn't get a republic. Mm. It's a compromise. It's statesmanlike.
Yeah. They seceded, but they were still a dominion. So they're almost less a part of the empire than ever before.
It maintains some connection. And then in Ireland, you know, it's the building block of a free state. Collins describes it in the Dáil as the freedom to achieve freedom. Mm. All the major newspapers support it. But then the Republican press can say, no, this is a compromise too far. We've lost the republic. So it's an amazing thing, the treaty. It can be spun in any way. And when you read the newspapers of a century ago, I think it's fair to say the power of the typewriter is very clear. Mm. And we know that the gun and the ballot box brought Britain to the table, you know, caused the treaty. But perhaps the typewriter did its bit too, you know, and it's interesting to look back on the press.
So what you're saying is that you'd like the illustrated bound compendium of Punch magazine and of the 1920s editions of The Spectator. That's what you're looking for Christmas, if Santa's very good to you. Donald Fallon has written a book called Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, which might make a very nice Christmas present for anyone who's into the modern history of the capital in your life. Donald is also the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere you get your audio online.